Hello and welcome to Parley, our weekly discussion podcast. I'm G. Sampat, the Hindu social affairs editor and your host for today. This week, we're going to be looking at right to work. This is a subject that's closely linked to an issue that was top of the agenda for the Bihar elections, unemployment. And of course, it's not something that concerns only Bihar. After what the pandemic and the lockdown has done to the economy, there is a tremendous hunger for jobs across the country. And not surprisingly, even in the Bihar elections, the main campaign plank of Tejaswi Yadav's RJD, which was expected to do well, was a promise to provide 10 lakh government jobs. From a policy perspective, this promise of 10 lakh jobs could be viewed as an instance of the state offering to deliver on the right to work. So what exactly is the status of this right in India? Is it a fundamental right? Does it or should it have legal protection? Is it something that policymakers should take seriously? Is it economically feasible given the nature of India's GDP growth, our recently reformed labor laws and India's fiscal constraints? To help answer these questions, we have with us two eminent social scientists, Ritika Khera, who teaches economics at IIT Delhi, and Amit Basole, who heads the Center for Sustainable Development at Azim Premji University, Bangalore. Ritika and Amit, welcome to Parley.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, to start with, Ritika, I'm going to ask you about the international scene. Like, what exactly is the status and the thinking about right to work in general? Are there some UN agreements that countries such as India have signed up to and can be held to?
The right to work was a big topic of discussion post Second World War, especially. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights includes the right to work in the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. In India, we don't have a constitutional right to work. Yeah. But what we do have, as you know, is the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, which is a step in the direction of a right to work. But this is a statutory right which flows from the NREGA law. And if the law is amended or withdrawn, the right will vanish. And so, you know, under NREGA, a person can hold the state accountable for not fulfilling the right by demanding an unemployment allowance. But again, if the law goes, then this also goes.
But isn't the right to work covered under right to life, which is a fundamental right?
Well, I think there is. Look, I'm not a lawyer and I don't know the legal position in Indian law. But I think there have been some cases in the courts, including in the Supreme Court, where the ambit of the right to life has been expanded to include all kinds of things. And I'm pretty sure that somewhere or the other, right to work may also have been included under the ambit of the right to life. But like I said, I'm not a legal expert and I don't follow court cases very carefully.
Okay. Coming to you, Amit, is the right to work a relevant or a meaningful concept anymore, given not just in India, but worldwide, the kind of growth path countries have been taking? And like, for instance, we have been seeing a substantially jobless kind of GDP growth over the past decade or so, if I'm not mistaken. And the ratio of jobs to GDP has also been steadily declining. So how do we make sense of implementing this kind of a concept in this kind of an economy?
Yeah, so I would say that under these circumstances, it becomes even all the more important for two main reasons. I mean, depending on how you look at the term right to work, often it is sort of interpreted as you did alongside unemployment or lack of availability of work. But there's also another sense of it, which is the right to be able to earn my livelihood. The way I'm doing it without any obstruction or interference and so forth. So in both those senses, what we have seen in the past few decades is that the path of development not only does not create adequate opportunities, employment opportunities which you referred to, but also actively dispossesses or displaces people from their means of livelihood as well. So on the one hand, displacement and dispossession, on the other hand, failure to create jobs, new jobs. Both of these make the right to work all the more important to imagine in a creative way today, and if possible, make it a legally enforceable right. Although here I will also say that, like Ritika, I have not been aware of the nitty-gritties of the debates on this. However, this is how I see it from an economic perspective.
Okay. So in terms of how we can make the right to work work, so to speak, Ritika, when some of the ideas which have come forth recently include those which focus on urban employment, and one of the ideas is decentralized urban employment and training, which has been mooted by Jean Dries. How do you view this kind of an approach?
Right. If I can, may I add to the previous question that you asked about jobless growth?
Sure.
Yeah. See, I think it's almost a strategy to talk about GDP growth only and not to talk about who is benefiting from that GDP growth. Yeah. And one part of it is also to, you know, we hardly ever hear about per capita GDP growth. We only hear about overall growth. And from people's welfare point of view, what matters is the per capita and the distribution issues, right? And this is important for the question that you're asking, because, you know, we have to think about what is an appropriate growth strategy for a labor surplus, labor abundant country like India. The kinds of technologies that are being used for production, manufacturing, etc., they were suitable for countries where they arose, you know, this automation, etc., but they may not be suitable for a country like India, because it will mean jobless growth if you have more and more automation. Yeah, so I think it is quite a fundamental question which doesn't get adequate attention. So to come to the question that you actually asked, so I think there are interesting things happening right now. One, of course, is the RJD manifesto, which will be nice to talk about. But if we talk about this proposal that actually, in fact, has been in circulation, and I think it was Amit Center that put out the first proposal, and then Jean has written about it as well, as you said. So the idea behind this urban employment and, you know, training kind of program is to, like NREGA, to create additional or new employment opportunities so that those who are unemployed or underemployed may be gainfully employed, and that they can earn a dignified living. And this dignity is supposed to come from work conditions, like being paid a fair wage and having regulated work hours, and also from the social value of the work that people do, right? So to do useful things like repairing school buildings, or cleaning parks or public toilets or maintaining footpaths, etc. So I think it is a workable agenda, I would say, but obviously to make it workable, we need not only political will, but also fiscal resources.
Yeah, Amit, would you like to add something on this? Because you've, in your State of Working report, you've also been stressing on the need for urban employment guarantee options and so on.
Yeah. So just briefly to add to what Ritika said, the perspective that we were coming from was not only the problem of low urban informal sector wages and lack of adequate work, but also the profound lack of public goods and assets, especially in the smaller towns, but also generally in urban India, that we thought that it is the state's responsibility to provide these public goods, and this can be kind of combined with an employment creation program, just like NREGA does. And in NREGA too, the asset creation part is often underemphasized. So we thought it's high time to do both these things together, and it can be done through something like an urban employment guarantee. in terms of the feasibility and implementation, there are lots of problems to be considered, and we've been working through some of those. Interestingly, a few states have launched what some states are calling a guarantee, although it may not really be a guarantee. However, they are urban employment programs, particularly Odisha, Jharkhand, and Himachal are the three states that launched it in the wake of COVID to meet the particular COVID employment crisis. Kerala had one from earlier. So we are kind of, seeing some bits and pieces of this policy which could, be used as learnings going ahead. If, say, we wanted to try it out on a national scale, as I said, there are a lot of issues do remain to be worked out. But together with NREGA, something like an urban employment guarantee can be a very important piece of the puzzle for, reaching the right to work, on the way to the right to work.
And then would you say then the right to work is more or less the idea would be equivalent to an employment guarantee? Is that what it's about?
No, I wouldn't reduce it to an employment guarantee. So, if you take a step back, what is happening here? What we are talking about is what is the responsibility of the state in a capitalist economy where welfare and employment are not a guaranteed byproduct of private economic activity. So if private economic activity cannot generate adequate, decent livelihoods or also displaces livelihoods, like I said earlier, then what is it? What is incumbent on the state to do? That is the question. And so I view this as it's a holistic thing. So you're talking not only about the state generating its own work for public goods, for education, for healthcare, for administration, for all the things that the state is supposed to do, it should generate its own employment. That then it's also supposed to safeguard people's employment, right? So everything from ensuring that street vendors have vending zones, to fisher workers, fish workers' rights are protected, to farmers have adequate viable income, and all of this comes broadly under the right to livelihood and right to work. One small part of that can be an employment guarantee, but by no means is it the only thing.
So speaking of the state's role and responsibilities here, of course, Ritika earlier mentioned about the RJD's promise of 10 lakh government jobs. So this kind of an approach where the government plays a very large role as an employer, so to speak, how do you see that happening going forward? Ritika, would you want to pitch in on this RJD's scheme? What do you think about it?
Right. So, it's like a page in the manifesto, but some of the points are quite interesting. I found it quite interesting and, in fact, even appealing. So, one thing is that it picks up on the issue of vacant posts in government jobs. Yeah, there are many posts that are already sanctioned, but to which people have not been recruited so far. And many of these are likely to be essential services like teachers, nurses, other health workers like Asha Didis, Anganwadi workers, doctors even maybe. So not only will this promise create employment, it will also hopefully fill the void in these essential services which are sorely lacking, especially in Bihar. This is a serious problem. The second kind of interesting thing is that the manifesto promises fulfilling the demands of Anganwadi workers and a few other worker categories. And across the country, actually, not just in Bihar, I don't know if you know that a lot of these workers, frontline workers, especially in these health services, have been agitating, asking for a fair wage. I mean, it's really shocking. In fact, ASHA workers who are supposed to go door to door, they're not even paid a salary in many states. They're just paid an honorarium because they're treated as volunteers. The other thing that they mention in the RJD manifesto is equal pay for equal work. And I think that demand is kind of acknowledging the fact that currently contract teachers are a huge share of all teachers, right? So we have regular teachers with permanent contracts, and then we have contract teachers who have these temporary contracts, but they are also paid very little. So they're saying that there should be equal pay for equal work, which is a well-recognized principle in law as well. I mean, I think there's a law which calls for this. So I think the ideas in the RJD manifesto are interesting, and by the way, they also have something like the DUET, the the urban employment program that Jean has written about, and Amit Center's proposal also. So that kind of thing also can, that will probably generate the extra jobs.
So on RJD, you were saying that the manifesto promise of 10 lakh government jobs, it's based on several interesting ideas, because it seeks to use the creation of social services and also employment generation both, by addressing the addressing fair wages for Anganwadi workers, making those kinds of services as permanent jobs for teachers, health workers, Anganwadi workers, and so on.
So I'm not sure if they're promising permanent jobs, but they are promising equal pay for equal work. And these details obviously are not in the manifesto. It's a one-page promise as far as employment opportunities are concerned. So all of this will have to be fleshed out, including where the money going to come from. Because we know that there are these vacant posts, but are they central government posts? In which case, I suppose the money will have to come primarily from the central government. But if they are promising to create new jobs through at the state level, then we'll also have to figure out the resources for this. Because we know that most state governments are, their finances are in a bad situation.
Okay. Amit, do you want to add something on this idea where I think in other countries, for example, in Thailand, they've done this where they see that, for example, the healthcare sector is really underserved. The people do a lot of out-of-pocket expenditure, and in trying to create a sort of a universal healthcare kind of a system where it's labor intensive. You've got thousands and hundreds and thousands of nursing jobs being created. You're both addressing a public healthcare or public infrastructure need, and at the same time, you're also addressing an employment generation need. So do you think this is a way that India can look to adopt?
Yeah, absolutely. And, this has been an idea that's been out there for a while. And last year when we did the Urban Employment Guarantee paper, we also alongside did something called Universal Basic Services. This term's also out there in several countries. And the idea is very much what you said, that once again, it is incumbent on the state to provide these basic services, whether we talk about health, education, housing, a few can be named. And in providing them, of course, employment is generated. So I think there's little disagreement that the state should provide this. There can be disagreement on whether it should be universally the same, and whether there's room for private provisioning in health education. All of that, there will be disagreements. But I don't think people disagree that we need to expand spending on these things as a country. We are nowhere near comparable countries, comparable in terms of GDP per capita. For example, Vietnam and many other countries spend quite a bit more as a percentage of their GDP. So we should do that, and that will create jobs. There is the fiscal question, which I maybe at the at the end we can come to this together. So we collect all the spending questions, so to speak, where the money will come from, and talk about that. But yes, the idea is definitely a good one.
Okay, so moving on to a slightly different aspect of right to work. So when we look at, when we consider work, we are of course not only looking at work for work's sake, but work as a means to access money, which is necessary to access the basic necessities of life. So there has been some thinking around this, and the question has been asked, what if we delink this access to money from work, and which is what a universal basic income strategy would suggest. So given the fact that India has got a huge labor surplus, and whether it's really, given the nature of the economy, whether it's possible or not to create so many job opportunities, is there an argument to be made that a universal basic income rather than a right to work is perhaps the way forward? Amit, would you like to pitch in on this?
Okay. So there's been a lot of ink spilled on this, especially the employment guarantee versus UBI and so forth. I'm not opposed to some kind of a basic income grant, although in our case it is not going to be universal, most likely. Right? But again, to see where this idea has come from, this is a response to the failure of the pattern of economic growth to create remunerative and meaningful work. So, in the developed countries, that's very much the context, I think, in which this is, all of this is coming from. And they, of course, have some resources to devote to something like this. In our case, it's a very different proposition. I think that it may have a role. Something like a basic income grant can have a role in a policy mix that addresses broadly the question of welfare, in India. But we can do a lot more in providing work, creating work. Work is an important source not only of money but also of identity, fulfillment, all of these things. So I think because we are so used to thinking of work also in terms of informality, degrading conditions, and so forth, that this takes a backseat. That in fact it is a core part of being human to do fulfilling work. I would very much want that to be the focus, while not necessarily negating the role for a basic income grant somewhere in the mix.
Okay, Ritika, would you agree with that point of view? Or
so I think that in the current moment, the discussion around UBI, Universal Basic Income, has picked up. Because of the failure that Amit talked about, yeah, the failure to generate remunerative work. But the idea has been around for much longer, and I think it also has very progressive roots, but that's not the moment right now. What is interesting to me is that at the moment, the big supporters of UBI in the US, for instance, are people like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. And that, to me, raises questions about, why is that happening? As it happens, these are also people who are driving a lot of the automation processes that are killing jobs.
Right.
So I think it's something to ponder over, at least. Is to what extent is this support for UBI self-serving or in the public interest when it comes from people like that. Now, in the Indian context, this UBI, what has gotten discussed is actually a very mangled version of the actual thing, right? Because immediately people say it can't be universal because of the cost. And in fact, others say it can't be universal because of equity concerns. Why should I get the money, any money, when I already have such a well-paying job from government? And then also the amounts that have been discussed barely qualify as basic income, right? And then on top of that, whenever these programs have been discussed, it's always in the context of, okay, we'll have to roll back X or Y program. In order to finance it. Yeah. So this was in the economic survey that Arvind Subramaniam had authored a chapter on UBI, where they were looking at how other programs could be scaled down to make fiscal space for UBI. So I would say that for many different reasons, I'm kind of skeptical of the idea of UBI, both internationally in its current avatar, as well as in the Indian context, in a very different mangled version.
Okay. So, Amit, again, sticking to the Indian context and getting a little bit more specific in terms of the ground realities, that is, recently we've had those the change in the labor law regime, where 44 old laws have been codified into like four labor codes. So, and many would argue that these labor codes have sort of resulted in a dilution of whatever rights, regardless of how strictly they were being implemented or not being implemented. There has been a dilution of the right to work in terms of actual in work, as workers are working. So, in this scenario, how meaningful is it to speak of a right to work in today's India, given the labor regime? Ritika, would you like to comment on that? Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, Amit, you can probably go first and then Ritika can pitch it.
Okay, to start on the labor codes. Now, you're right to question, you know, is it at all worth raising the right to work question when very fundamental rights at work or in work are being violated, and not only violated for lack of legislation, but also legislation being diluted. So in terms of the labor law code changes and so forth, one thing that, in the way I think about it is, going back to what Ritika said earlier, it's a labor surplus economy. We all know that. We know that in the capital labor bargaining process, labor is structurally weak in India, which means that the state, it's incumbent again on the state to provide that support to labor, which is structurally weak. The state has been doing the opposite. All of us know that as well. So it has abdicated on a very fundamental responsibility in that sense. Now, coming to the changes, I mean, I would put it very simply as, you know, if you look at three dimensions of these things, welfare, equity, and efficiency. By welfare, I mean, what is the universal floor beyond which we don't allow things to fall, whether that is working conditions or other job security or whatever else. Welfare, equity meaning, how equally are protections, labor protections, actually shared given scarce state capacity? The government doesn't have infinite capacity to enforce things. So given its constraints, how equally are these protections afforded to workers? And efficiency, meaning do laws actually get in the way of scaling up of businesses and achieving productivity gains? The conversation revolves around all of these things. Now, the current changes do not improve the universal floor, which they should have done. So on the welfare front, they don't do much. On the equity front, what they really do is they take away certain protections from the well-protected part and do not increase the protections to the under-protected part. So there is no redistribution, which you might even be willing to accept to an extent. But what they've done is made it easier to convert permanent workers into contract workers through the IR bill, but have done nothing to end the contract system. So overall, they've reduced the average standards. That's on the equity front. And on the efficiency front, it remains to be seen. I mean, it's possible that some of these compliances being coming down and so forth can help small enterprises to expand. And that might be the only good thing to possibly come out of this, but time will tell.
Okay. Ritika, you wanted to add anything to this?
Yeah, just very briefly. I think over the decades, there has been a dilution of worker rights in India. This has happened through the law and also in the implementation of whatever legal protections exist. However, this very key point gets completely lost in the debate that happens, say, in English dailies, for instance, because there the narrative, mainstream narrative, is still that law is labor is pampered and there are all kinds of ridiculous compliances that the companies have to fulfill and all of that. But that segment of the workforce is just like 5 or 10%, right? For the rest, it's basically a free for all. It's a free market of the most exploitative kind, right? There is very poor legal protection for them. There is very little awareness of the protections that do exist. And there is very weak proactive implementation of the legal protections that are there. And I think these labor law, these labor codes that have just come into being, they're sort of furthering that kind of process of, I think, weakening the position of labor in the Indian market.
Okay.
Add one small thing to that.
Please.
Just to connect it to what we were talking about, employment guarantee earlier, an employment guarantee, an effective employment guarantee program, can be an excellent solution to the structural weakness of labor that I mentioned. So, given that we have, as I said, constrained state capacity, enforcing laws is not all that easy. There are all kinds of political economy considerations there too. Tightening the labor market is an excellent way to ensure that workers are treated well. This is how we also see this employment guarantee functioning as far as the rights in work is concerned, not the right to work, but the rights in work, that if the state steps in and significantly reduces the surplus labor, particularly in the casual market and so forth, then it automatically creates the conditions for better treatment of workers through this tightening.
Right. Amit, speaking of tightening the labor market, there's an interesting alternative scenario which I wanted maybe both of you to come in on, which is Haryana's 75% reservation of jobs in the private sector for locals. There is, of course, a political dimension to it, and given our topic for the day, would that constitute a kind of a violation of the right to work as well? Like, how would you look at it?
Ritika, you want to
go first? Can go first.
Oh, okay. Sure. So, yeah, this is, again, a very thorny issue, and many states have tried some kind of thing like this. I can see where the objections come from, obviously, and there are some objections coming from the capital side, which is, investment and investment climate suffers and so forth, and there are objections coming from labor side too, which is about the freedom to move in wherever you want in the country to work and so forth. However, I can also see where this is coming from. This goes back to what we've been discussing throughout this program, which is this inability of the growth process to generate employment, and particularly for youth. So youth-educated unemployment is very high. That's in fact where entirely India's unemployment is concentrated, among educated youth, more or less. So that's how I see this. These are responses to that particular problem. Of course, they are not solutions, but they raise the legitimate question, how can we ensure that there are adequate local opportunities so that people don't need to go long distances, particularly don't need to go for long distances for very precarious and underpaid work, for sure. But in general, if they don't wish to migrate and they wish to work where they are from, then we should be able to do that. We should be able to provide them that, and we are failing to do that. So that's the context in which I see these policies. They don't work in and of themselves, but there is a legitimate grievance at the root of it, I think.
Okay, Ritika, you wanted to add to that?
Well, before I heard Amit, I was going to say that this conceiving such laws should be considered an act of a tukde-tukde gang. I am saying it jokingly, but there is this problem, right, that on the one hand, some voices in government want to create one nation, one market. That was, that has been said in the context of GST and also this electronic market. And on the other hand, some state governments are coming up with these ideas, such as reserving jobs. So I'm not sure how much buy-in the law will have from the private sector, how it is going to be enforced, whether introducing such a distortion in the labor market will reap any substantive benefits for labor itself, even for local labor, right? And I feel that the emphasis should be on generating jobs and generating jobs in large numbers rather than trying to fix the problem in this divisive way.
Right. I think there is a lot going on in this whole politics of unemployment. I think it requires an episode to itself to look at it in detail. I just want to move to a somewhat different area here. For example, this question of right to work. We've been speaking in terms of employment guarantee and dignity and so on, but in the United States, it's basically the MNCs and the billionaires who have been advocating for the right to work, and there it's more like the right of a worker who does not need to be a part of a union but still wants to be employed. So it's become like a union busting kind of a tactic which undermines collective bargaining, and given the kind of increasing integration of global markets and economies, is there any danger of something like this happening in India, where an idea comes in as a progressive kind of a formulation, like for example with the UBI, and then you get a legislation which is completely different. Is that a real threat, or am I being too paranoid here? Amit?
Well, I think you know, we definitely shouldn't underestimate the power of whoever it is you're talking about, capital or elites or whatever, to subvert pretty much any progressive agenda to their needs. That happens a lot, and I don't think that is being paranoid. In this particular context of the women busting in the US, I don't know enough. I know just about exactly what you said, actually, is my understanding. But I don't see that as a really a relevant issue for us at this point.
Okay, and Ritika, is there anything you want to add here?
Right. So, you know, because I wanted to see what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights includes, I Googled I DuckDuckGoed right to work. And it was really interesting that the first hit for right to work is this American interpretation of it that you have just described. And really, it's the first time in my life that I see the right to work being interpreted in this manner. So, and I wonder if it's even if I use DuckDuckGo, I get that as the first hit, not the second or third hit. But it's interesting what search engines or how search engines can shape our understanding of some of these very crucial ideas also, unless you're very vigilant. Now, you know, whether this American kind of interpretation of right to work is likely to happen in India, I think that this is a pretty blatant kind of case of, you know, mangling a good idea. But I would say that America is not a role model as far as social and economic rights are concerned, yeah, or socioeconomic rights are concerned. And that generally for socioeconomic rights, it's the Western European and the Scandinavian countries that one looks to more often for interesting solutions and ideas and progressive ideas. But we have to be vigilant. I mean, elements of plutocracy in India are visible everywhere you look. So it wouldn't be surprising if, you know, these kinds of anti-labor interpretations become fine currency.
Right. Okay. We now on to the final question here. So I'll go with Ritika first. So, do you think, taking a step back at a broader political and a philosophical level, isn't at some level asking for the right to work, sort of setting the bar a bit too low in terms of politics? I mean, as human beings, we spoke of dignity and, you know, access and so on. Shouldn't we be actually asking for the right to leisure? Isn't that what we deserve?
Isn't there a really old poster from that Second World War period which says 8 hours of work, 8 hours of leisure, and 8 hours of rest? I think that is the original kind of demand. And I think that's possibly the correct way to view this, is that if you guarantee good 8 hours of work, then automatically you're guaranteeing that the rest is for you to enjoy your life or the fruits of your labor.
Right. I mean, yeah, I guess if there is ever a proper legislation on this, right to leisure should be, I guess, one of the clauses or the key clauses. Amit, any thoughts on this question?
As Ritika said, this is an old debate, and in fact, Right to be Lazy is this book from the 19th century, I think, Paul Raffage, book which is a response to the right to work campaign going on at the time. And he was saying, why are you asking for the right to work? We should ask for the right to be lazy. And this has been a continuing debate, particularly in Marxian political economy. Of course, it's a very live debate. That just as you said, it plays into essentially capitalism and the work ethic, right? It's the right to work is basically the right to be exploited by capital, and that is a perfectly fair point of view, I think, as far as I am concerned. If you are really looking for a future of humanity beyond all of this, then clearly one cannot take this narrow a perspective. And work should be fulfilling, work should be creative, and work has to be put in its place, which is hopefully a very small place, And we had many moments of people prophesizing that capitalism would produce enough surplus for work days to reduce, work weeks to reduce, leisure to increase. You know, there's been endless writing about this from Keynes on down. This hasn't always happened. It happened some places. In other places, it's quite the opposite that has happened. Working hours have increased, and Juliet Shore has done quite a nice work on this long durée kind of work on capitalism and working hours, for example. But more recently, you do find that in certain European countries, they are becoming serious about reducing the work, increasing leisure. In our context, again, is different, right? So the question, as always, is do we pass through these stages of industrial capitalism and so forth to emerge on the other side in some sort of post-industrial society where leisure is valued again? Or can we imagine other paths, you know, without dragging ourselves through sort of this mud, so to speak? And, you know, of course, I don't have the answer to that, but there are many lively debates going on.
Right. Yeah, the debates and the struggles to find the right place for work. Yeah, I think that something is going to be ongoing. Ritika, any last words on this whole discussion? You have the last words.
No, thank you. I think I've said enough.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ritika and Amit. It was a pleasure talking to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sampath.